Here.
Dr.
Caputo?
Caputo? Go ahead, Christina.
Oh, sorry, sorry, Sherry, go ahead.
All right. Dinar?
Present.
Earl?
Kevin Earl.
Kevin? Earl?
He's muted.
Okay. Harris?
Here.
Morrow? And Tanner?
Here.
Yeah, hi, it's Dr. Harris.
Well,
right here.
Again, I just want to thank everybody for devoting the time to be on this committee. I think it's an important one. Why don't we just go around and kind of introduce ourselves? I think we're all probably somewhat familiar with each other, but I think the introduction and kind of just a brief background about ourselves will help. Sherry, would you mind just kind of running through the people that are here, calling us out, and we can give that introduction?
Yes. Hero?
Anthony Hero, current president of the State Dental Board, chair of the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee. I have private practice in Central Phoenix, where I've been there for close to 20 years, and I'm in my final year of my first term on the dental board.
Caputo? Absent. Dinar?
Hi, so some of you know me. My name is Adi Dinar. I'm a public member on the dental board. In my day job, I sue government agencies like the dental board. but obviously, for conflict of interest purposes, I have never sued the dental board itself. But I do have some knowledge about administrative procedures, administrative law, and how agency adjudication functions, and you know, this is my second term on the board. I don't know when my term expires. I think it's in 2025, and I think this committee is very important. I echo what Dr. Hero said, and I'm looking forward to the discussion that we do in this committee.
Kevin Earl.
Good afternoon. I think I know most of you as well. I'm the former executive director of Bodex. Before that, the executive director of the New Jersey Board of Dentistry. And for 11 years, I was the executive director of the Arizona Dental Association. I'm still working with the Dental Association on government relations responsibilities. And so in that capacity, I am participating in this process.
Harris?
Again, I think I know just about everybody there. I'm a private practice oral and maxillofacial surgeon. Been practicing for 25 years and been a consultant for the dental board for, I don't know, 16, 17 of those.
Connor?
Jeff Tonner, I'm an attorney in private practice. All of my clients are dentist or dental related. I've done about 4,000 cases before the dental board. I like to tell people I defend the innocent. I also have I defend dentists in civil malpractice cases. I write contracts for dentists, lecture on risk management and ethics and other stuff. So I'm here as kind of the I think it's an important committee as well, and I'm here to kind of give the perspective of the dentist.
And we'll step around with Dr. Caputo can introduce himself.
Hello, everyone. Anthony Caputo. I am a anesthesiologist in Tucson, also a dental educator for about 30-plus years now. I've served in various capacities with the board. Since I've been licensed, so just going on 25 years now, and currently part of the investigative committee and chair that committee, and I think through that capacity was sort of reached out to about participating with this committee, which I'm happy to do. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. I, again, just really appreciate your time. I reached out to all of you either directly or kind of indirectly. And thankfully, everybody that, you know, our first, my kind of wish list of people said yes, because I think everybody's bringing a unique and really valuable perspective. So I look forward to some fruitful conversations and some good recommendations to the board. Let's move on to agenda item number 3, scope of work. Ryan, do you want to give us kind of a brief background on the audit and maybe kind of a prologue to the audit, because a lot of it came out of this audit I know you were prepared for. A lot of this wasn't necessarily a surprise, which is why I was kind of ready to act on the formation of this committee, because I think it's just the natural solution to a lot of the issues that came out of that audit. But Ryan, why don't you give us just a little background?
So the audit, which I think we as staff have kind of been prepared for a bit of time and kind of knew some of the results, simply because when I walked in the doors, I knew that there were some challenges, and there are still some to be faced for quite some time. And I've heard stories about when you are in a relationship, sometimes if you break up in a relationship, if you're in a relationship for 2 years, it takes twice as long to recover from a breakup. This has kind of been akin to that. While there's not really a breakup, I don't know how long it will take to recover from some of the stuff that we've, Christina and I, have unearthed since we've been here. We knew from the get-go that the auditors were going to be looking at multiple things, policies and procedures, which that was the first question I asked when I got hired. Kevin, I know you probably have a whole book of policies and procedures. When I walked in, there was not one. We actually have one, that you can't smoke in the building, which I thought was super awesome, considering it's probably dated from like 1978. And so there was quite a few policies and procedures. So there's no real policies and procedures on compliance. There is now. We've written a few since. Sherry's working on a couple more right now regarding CE audits and stuff like that. But this audit helped out. Sometimes it sucks to go through this process, but it also helps know where you can correct your wrongs. And so while this was not a fun audit to read or be a part of, it certainly gives us an idea of what the higher authorities are looking for when they're trying to make changes. So a few things that stand out pretty significantly are guidelines, that the board follow guidelines, as there should be some sort of baseline. And each case has to go on its own merits. Your own attorney will tell you that. But if there's similar cases, it's an endo procedure, and you did a CE for endo, like 4 hours of CE, and I have no idea what you would do, but, and it's a non-disciplinary order. Should all endo procedures, especially if it's a first-time offender, have the same sort of guideline, that type of thing? So the whole purpose of this committee is to read the findings of the audit and then establish ways that this board can be better in its review of complaints. Another one was conflicts of interest and things like that. I actually defended our conflicts of interest. I think we're doing it fine. And I actually quoted the statutes on why I think we're doing it fine. And they think we should have some sort of, they called it a special file, but didn't define what the special file was. It was a little bit bizarre, but I also don't want to split hairs where I don't need to split hairs. So if we can do things better, that's the whole point. But I also, because I am not the board, I'm staff hired by the board, and all of our staff are appointed by the board or through me. I wanted the board to come up with a plan of action that they wanted to see, because this is your audit, the board's audit, and their response. And so Dr. Hero said it would be a good idea to start an ad hoc committee. This committee won't make any decisions other than recommendations to the full board to either adopt, modify, or reject. I think that covers everything. Dr. Hero, if you want to add to it, feel free.
Yeah, well, honestly, even before the audit was initiated, just to speak as a private practice dentist who's on the dental board, which I think is a lot of the the professional members on the board. One of the most frustrating aspects when you first get on is you don't really know how to initiate action or what action should be initiated against a licensee based upon certain deviations. And we've had turnover in the AG's office. Thankfully, we have Seamus now, and it sounds like that could be, you know, a long-term relationship, which would be great. Because since my time on the board, I think we're on our third or fourth attorney. And so you're oftentimes getting the perspective of that attorney, and then it changes, and that influences the type of action that the board's recommending. So there's really a lack of consistency and a lack of experience and education by new board members on knowing how to adjudicate a case. So my hope with this committee is going to be, you know, the recommendations that come out, hopefully the board adopts or tweaks, but whatever gets finalized will get passed on to future board members so that we have consistency, not just with the board members that currently exist, but future board members that are put on. Particularly when it comes to the types of action that's decided upon in the board. So I think the launching off point that we should discuss is, how do you guys think we should begin? I mean, do you want to take it one item at a time from the audit, or is there another recommendation? And I'll just open it up to the floor. You guys can jump in and speak. If you want to raise your hand, go ahead and I'll call on you, but it doesn't have to be that formal. So I'll just open the floor up. Yeah, please, go ahead.
There's something in the substantive policy statements that kind of lays out. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I'd need more clarification on what you're referring to.
Okay. If you want to go to, if you can Google this, go to the substantive policy statements. If you want to put in AZ Dental Board substantive policy statements. And open that up. And it's like number 26 or somewhere in that area.
Which one are you looking for? I'm there, but 26 is opioid continuing education.
Okay, hang on. Let me get there. I'm not there yet. It's right around there somewhere.
Guidelines for imposing sanctions against licensees.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 24.
There you go. If you look at that, they first have a list of the statutory citations and what they could be, and they run through that whole thing. And then beyond that, there is a whole thing about what revocation means, suspension, censure, et cetera. I don't know if that's a starting point. I think most people are unaware this even exists, and I really don't ever know the board to ever or rarely to refer to this. But I don't know. Does this help at all?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Jeff, to your point, I think you're right. I don't think that anybody refers to it. I can tell you in a recent meeting with the investigative committee, we went through a training session with the AG, and this was never brought up. So that's an interesting point. I'm not trying to confuse the issue at this point either, but I just wanted to toss it back to what Skip put out there today too about identifying or defining what it means to be professional. So that could also potentially be a starting point here too. And I just want to throw one more thing out, and this is more directed to Jeff. In really going back to what he said about representing the dentist. So I just out of a curiosity question, having nothing to do with anything particularly, but in the cases that you've represented or been involved in, do you have a sense of fairness in the decisions that are made? Do you think they're right where they need to be? Do you think they're oftentimes too lenient? Do you think that the board could do more? And again, I'm just curious is more so why I'm asking that question, particularly from your perspective. I'd be interested to kind of see what you think.
The board decisions vary on year to year, depending on who comes and who goes. And as you know, most of the board meetings, the decisions driven by one or two people. Unfortunately, I think some of the members show up having read nothing. But I think they're really good right now. And I'm not just saying that because Anthony's sitting here, but I really do. In the past, we've had other members who've been really rough, especially dentist members. And I don't think we have any of that. So right now, I think they're pretty good. And I tell my clients that too. I said, if you're going to have a board case, this is a good time to have. And I think their decisions are mostly good. In the past, when we've had some members who were really, I consider to be anti-dentist, I struggled with them.
Kevin, before I call on you, Anthony referenced a definition as potentially a launching off point. Skip, do you want to explain that? Because that
Dr. Hero, can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. So I would shy away from a profession, from a definition of professional conduct. Just as an aside, if it's not unprofessional conduct, then it technically is not in the purview of the board. Unprofessional conduct is extremely defined in your statutes and delineated for workable purpose. And because this committee does not have the authority to ask for statutory changes or interpret statutes, it really just needs to focus on the unprofessional conduct and how it wants to, you know, if you're going to do some kind of matrix or substantive policy statement, that you center it around the unprofessional conduct, because that's what the board regulates.
Appreciate it, Seamus.
No problem.
Then Kevin, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great observation that, you know, we have a very comprehensive list of items that are considered to be unprofessional conduct. But what, in my observation from board meetings over the years, there's a lot of ebb and flow depending on the quality of the practitioners that are on the board. And I agree with Jeff that the current makeup of the board has improved considerably. But what I do see is a lot of inconsistency, that board members sometimes have trouble articulating exactly what the deviation from a standard of care is, for example. You can make a statement saying, well, that's a deviation from the standard of care, but the rest of the board members, including your public members, your business entity member, who's really not in a business entity, by the way, should have the ability to understand, if some Mr. Dinar can understand exactly what are the challenges with the treatment that have been provided here, and articulating, you know, how that can be categorized as something that's unprofessional conduct. And you do have that sort of catch-all phrase something that is potentially damaging to the health, welfare, and safety of the public. That's really the shoehorn category for deviations. But then there's a lot of other areas of the Dental Practice Act, which I'm not sure that the board members are familiar with all other parts of the Dental Practice Act. And I think they have trouble articulating it. And then there's this tendency to jump forward and saying, oh, let's do this. You know, what's the punishment, without identifying what the problem is and then matching up the punishment with the crime. And you're also not supposed to know about priors. I mean, you get to priors only at a certain stage. And sometimes the board members want to just leap ahead to the punishment before identifying exactly what the crime is.
That's well articulated, Kevin. Appreciate it. Dr. Morrow, welcome and congratulations on your new position.
Thanks.
I don't know exactly when you logged in. We basically just introduced everybody, did a short welcome, and are talking about the best launching off point for going through this. So you haven't missed too much yet.
I may be in and out too. So
okay, Ryan shared on Mr. Connor's recommendation a substantive policy statement that talks about guidelines for imposing sanctions against licensees. And it's somewhere in the comment section, I think, that could be a useful launching off point. Truthfully, I hadn't seen it. I've been on the board a year less than you. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but I mean, it's good information. Go ahead, Dr. Harris.
I think the problem is that this is not soldier proof. It's not idiot proof enough. And I know that sounds like an odd way to put it, but having watched this over the years, I will tell you that I don't think we can get everybody on the committee to agree what unprofessional conduct means in every circumstance. And I think that it's really easy to say, oh, sure, we killed the patient, so that's unprofessional. But what happens when somebody has a fatality that's not their fault, but they didn't have a license? Is that unprofessional? I do. But what I'm getting at is that I think the problem is we don't deal well with nuance. We're pretty good at managing cases that are cut and dry, but we're not great at nuanced cases, of which many of them are very nuanced. I was aware of this substantive policy statement, but I think the reason it hasn't had a great impact is it's not clear enough. I guess I would think that maybe we need something more like a diagram that gives, you know, question by question choices, almost like an ACLS protocol. You know, start off, did the dentist have a license? If yes, then, you know, go to, you know, your next box. If no, then immediately go to unprofessional conduct. You know, like I think we need to break it down into every possible turning point and guide the members into having a more consistent view of each branch. And I do think that some baseline definitions are going to need to be used, whether we're trying to have something changed in law. I don't have an opinion on that, but I think you're going to get an awful lot of people who don't think the law is clear on what the definition of professional or unprofessional conduct is. And I think that we can come up with some real common sense areas that we can all agree either are professional or unprofessional and use that to help people guide their decisions. But we need to lay it out carefully. I mean, with scary detail, otherwise we're going to get a lot of misunderstanding, just like the current substantive policy statement creates.
Great. I think they're great points. I do think, you know, I mean, I guess speaking as a board member, I would want the ability to still fall back on every case needs to be judged on its own and not get pigeonholed into taking action because that's what the flowchart says. But I like I said at the beginning, one of the most difficult things as a new board member, and even at this point, is the absence of good guidelines that help influence the decision between non-disciplinary and disciplinary, for example. With respect to the definitions, I think that's going to kind of come up organically as we talk. I've seen that in the Anesthesia and Sedation Committee meetings where, you know, we're going through the language and then all of a sudden there'll be a question about, well, maybe this is not defined or not properly defined. And then, you know, we can talk to counsel at that point to see how to best proceed. But I think they're great points, Skip. So I guess falling back, just to kind of push everybody a little bit, specifically, how do we want to get started? Do we want to look at this substantive policy statement and bring it up to date, or just jump right into the first point on the audit report, or is there another idea? Ryan, you got your hand up.
Thank you, Dr. Herbert. So I just want to offer some information regarding substantive policy statements. This agency, more than any agency I've worked for, uses substantive policy statements more as a, I'll say, crutch versus anything else, because substantive policy statements are general in either Adi or even Seamus will tell you that substantive policy statements are supposed to be like a stopgap for a period of time. Any substantive policy statement is created by a board should either end up in rule or statute, or it's really not that useful because it's supposed to be a stopgap until you can get a rule. A substantive policy statement is how you interpret, how the board interprets a statute or a rule, not so much as a guideline. And so I think for me, the way I read the audit on the sunset audit is, they're asking that the board come up with guidelines on how they're going to review cases that come before them. And if they can do it uniformly, then that's what we should aim for, kind of like what Dr. Harris was talking about with, if yes, you go to the next section, and then if yes, you just keep traveling down, and then you end up where you're at. I would prefer not to update the substantive policy statement. And eventually, I think we should work at removing the substantive policy statements and either work toward getting a rule related to the substantive policy statement or let it expire or something of that nature. Did I say that correctly, Seamus? Or Adi, I'm sure you probably have some information on the substantive policy statements as well.
You did, Ryan. And also, substantive policy statements aren't, you know, from auditor to auditor, they change, you know, whether they like substantive policy statements or they don't. It's the same with disciplinary matrices. You know, you could have one audit where they enjoy it. Your next audit 8 years later, they don't like it. So, you know, that can be kind of a moving pendulum that you have to stay with. But you are correct when it comes to substantive policy statements.
Can I just point out, like, in the current substantive policy statement, there's a statement or a failure or refusal to maintain adequate patient records is the conduct description. And they have that listed as unprofessional. But I've been in cases where I think they didn't maintain adequate records, but it was probably not unprofessional conduct. And then they go on to list that there's potential minimum or maximum disposition. Letter of concern, non-disciplinary CE, disciplinary CE, or probation with monitoring. That's how it's listed. I think the precise problem we have is I don't think we have any consistency between letter of concern, non-disciplinary CE, disciplinary CE, or probation with monitoring. The problem we have is we don't have a matrix to decide if somebody doesn't have proper record keeping, which one of those four does the board choose. And I think the purpose of this board is to decide how to parse that out, at least in some generality. Does that make sense? So the substantive policy statement kind of states the obvious, but it doesn't help anybody with any guidelines.
Kevin.
And maintenance of records. And if you're going to cite that as a violation, failure to maintain records, you should be citing the statutory site on what needs to be in a record. The problem that I see with that, and actually the association's working on some corrections to the patient records, maintenance of records section of the statute, is that a lot of that is vague. If you look at other statutory constructs in other states, it says specifically what needs to be in a patient record. And so you get wide variability on someone says, well, there were inadequate patient records. Well, what's an adequate patient record? If you read our statute, it's very confusing. And it jumps into specialist charting should include this. Well, for the most part, your general dentist. What does a general dentist need to have in the record? Like, for example, if you say someone didn't include periodontal charting, well, where does it say in the statute that you have to have periodontal charting?
Dr. Morrow?
To go along with what Kevin was saying is that there is an issue with some consistency. But then the problem is who maintains the record? Because we have those who are associates and those who are owners, and the owners have to maintain the record for the associate. And so that's where we have a lot of hiccups, is like, who's responsible for that? If that business entity closed down, declared bankruptcy, doesn't start again, we no longer have the record. And that's a big problem. And so that's one thing I worry about. We fight that all the time. Now, the other thing is, I've been on the board now 5.5 years. I could tell you how everyone except Mr. Diner votes. Mr. Diner, I've got no idea how you vote. And sometimes he gives us the no, and I'm like, what? Why no? And I'm sure you have this amazingly intelligent reason why you chose no. That's well above my head. But I can tell you with almost a certainty who's going to vote for what and how they're going to do it. Now, the problem you have is the makeup of the board changes, and the opinions of the individuals shouldn't be that. It should be more standardized to go along with that. Because I'll tell you, if someone hurts a kid, I just back up and I watch Dr. Beanstalk run the show, because she will go after that dentist all day long, and I will back her up 100% of the time, because she has the best interest for that kid at heart. Now, if there's a sedation issue, I go to Anthony or Dr. Christensen, because they're the ones that deal with sedation. So oftentimes I lean heavily on where these specialties lie, to give us the quote unquote standard of care. And standard of care is not something we can write down. We can't write down standard of care and be like, all right, you have to have X, Y, and Z, but we can have precedent in the past. Now, the other thing that I always look at is the patient been made whole? And the only way we can make a patient whole is if we elevate it to disciplinary, even if it doesn't warrant disciplinary, but we do believe that the patient should get their money back. And that puts us in a bind too, because then we start getting outside the level of what we can and can't do, because we're worried about the patient and whether or not they've been made whole or not. So those are the things that always go through my mind every single time we talk about things and elevate things or decrease. So that's kind of a whole word vomit of everything in my brain right now.
But well said, and I, you know, I would echo all that. And before I get to Dr. Harris and then Kevin, you know, on my recommendation, the board formed an investigative committee about a year ago. Dr. Caputo is the chair. Skip, you're vice chair right now, correct? So part of the rationale in forming that committee was, again, to just try to provide more consistency. You got more peers reviewing cases that can then make the recommendation to the board. So these guidelines are going to be all the more important, because right now, I think Drs. Caputo and Harris would probably agree with me. There's a bit of a disconnect between the committee and the board. And I think it's the lack of general guidelines to make these recommendations for what type of action should be taken. So I think we all understand the importance of why we're here and what we should focus on. It's how do we take the next step into really putting a pen to paper on what these guidelines should be.
You know, I think it's a bit of a disconnect. I think it's a disconnect.
Yeah.
I think it's quite a bit.
Yeah.
That the standard of care is looked at certain ways by specialists evaluating general dentists. And then I'm like, but then they go into weird tangents and so forth. And I'm like, no, we can't really rule on that or X, Y, and Z. Sometimes we get some weird reports that come back from the investigative committee that I said, ooh, that's really harsh or not even appropriate. So there's a number of times where I said, no, we're going to throw some of that out. But I guess it comes back to the board. Like you said, there's the disconnect of what we're looking for and what we're getting back. And sometimes I think, with all due respect to everybody on the board, sometimes it comes back flowery and look at all the amazing things that I can look and find wrong with this case. And it becomes very nitpicky, because you have a really great practitioners that think everybody is going to be practicing this level where standard of care is here. And so that's what I've got from a lot of the investigative committee back. Now, mind you, they do a lot of help for us. I love them. I mean, they're amazing, but some of the time I'm going, ooh, that's really harsh or overdone. There's a lot of, self-aggrandizement, as well as, there's some ego in some of these reports that come back.
Well, and again, I just think we need to establish some guidelines, because there's going to come a day when everybody here isn't involved on the board or the committee, and the hope would be we can lay some groundwork for the next generation to maintain consistency and to not have it be so dependent upon how that particular board member thinks or feels on that particular day. Skip, go ahead.
Forgive me, I wasn't trying to point out specifically anything to do with record keeping in my statement. What I want to get to, and I think we're kind of beating around it a little bit, is that I think we can all agree that we're not going to be able to write down what the standard of care is for obviously really good reasons. And I think we all pretty much know what the different punishment options are that we're typically using or that we're statutorily allowed to use. But what we're really not good at is figuring out what makes them different. What's the difference between a disciplinary CE and a non-disciplinary CE? What's the difference between a letter of concern and non-disciplinary CE? Can we do a non-disciplinary letter of concern? That's come up a bunch of times. So what I think we as a committee need to do is identify why we make those differentiations. And I think we start getting into intent. We start getting into whether they've been compliant with licensing. We start getting into whether they've been made whole already. These are all things that are really challenging subjects. And I think we need to identify where that starts and then work our way through the Christmas tree of, and I keep going back to the flow chart because I have a few, my personal opinion, that's what we're going to need. But, you know, I've seen pretty egregious things happen where we gave non-disciplinary CE because their intent was really good and they made a mistake. Okay, I think that's reasonable. I've also seen some cases where we gave really harsh disciplinary stuff to somebody just because they had a normal failure, but they didn't have a license for it in the case of anesthesia. So I don't think we should get caught trying to figure out what the standard of care is, and I don't think we should get caught trying to figure out what the punishment is. I think we need to figure out how we make the decision between the different punishments.
Well,
why?
You know, to go along with what Skip said there, it's really smart, and I don't mind a tier of, you know, diverting down like Christmas trees, like you said, but I think that should be in the investigative committee and not in the board response, because that may say, hey, this investigative committee, we're going to go this way because they didn't have this documentation. No perior probing gets us this way, and then it helps churn out some of the end goal, and then we're not limited in the board to past precedent. We're analyzing the case on the individual basis. So I like that.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, don't even put it in the board. Just put it in the investigative committee. That way it doesn't. And that way the board gets consistent results, but they're not bound by anything that is presented to them. And they're not expected to abide by a flow chart.
Sure.
This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan, guys. I'm not sure that we can, again, because we're here to make recommendations to the board for the board regarding. So maybe part of that, you know, maybe part of your discussions will be how to make that recommendation that the board implements this at the committee level, if that makes sense. Because it'll have to go two ways. You'll make the recommendation, but you also have to make a recommendation that the board then gives that to the investigative committee and doesn't utilize it themselves. And I'll look into that, whether you can do that or not in the meantime.
Kevin, why don't you go ahead?
I want to make two comments. Number one on standard of care. The term tends to get flipped around a lot, and the common parlance in risk management terms is the standard of care is what the reasonably prudent dentist would do under the same or similar circumstances. So, you know, it's not a hard and fast thing, and it's going to depend on the clinical circumstances, the patient's clinical presentation, what diagnostic data you have, and all that sort of stuff. So that's something not terminology, I think, that is reemphasized in the context of what the board does. And I also wanted to comment on Dr. Morrow's challenge about who owns, who retains the records. We are working on a draft at the Dental Association side, and we've involved the board attorneys that regularly appear before you for some input on that. Dr. Cobb and I are going to be meeting with Ryan to go over the draft that we have. We've also gotten the input, we're getting the input from the DSO group, who now has representation. And then there's some other issues with the business entities that I think are common problems. So we're working on that as a statutory fix for next session.
Is the representation from DSO, is it Heath Hall?
They have hired a lobbyist now, and their national guy was on the phone with us last week. We met last Thursday. And we also have a member of our CGA who's on the Council of Government Affairs for ADSO too. So.
Going back to this idea of a flowchart and issues we've seen on the board, one common one has been, at what point can we discuss prior action, and then how should that influence the type of action that is being given? Part of the issue as a board member, I've heard different things from the different attorneys that have represented us over the last few years. So I think that'll be good to dive into, particularly with this idea of a flowchart, to provide some guidance. And maybe, again, it's at the committee level and then changes a little bit at the board level, but I think it's worth diving into as well. Jeff?
Yeah, there's a statute on when you can look at priors. It's 32.1263.02. Oh, as an orange. And what it says, in determining the appropriate disciplinary action under this section, the board may consider previous non-disciplinary and disciplinary actions against the licensee. So 2 points to that. First of all, it has to be disciplinary action. So you can't look at priors if it's a letter of concern or if it's non-disciplinary CE. And then if you do decide that it's disciplinary, then the language says the board may consider. And in law, may means permissive, and shall or will means you have to. So you vote unprofessional conduct, then at that point you may, if you choose to, look at the priors.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't want to speak for Jeff, but so I don't know if he was trying to bring us back on track to what today's goal is. But essentially, I think what you would look at, and we couldn't add the audit to the actual document that you received. We added it as an attachment to your email. But if you look at page 6 of the audit, that's finding number 1, what Jeff was just talking about. And I'll just read it out loud for those that don't want to flip to it real quick. It just says, board has not considered nature and severity of complaints, substantiated violation, or licensee's history with taking enforcement action, potentially jeopardizing public health and welfare. Without going through a ton of excuses why or why not, I will tell you that the board staff, at least from my perspective, tried to explain what Dr. Hero said early on. If you count Mary Williams, we've had 5 attorneys in 3 years. And the advice, even from one attorney, hasn't been super consistent. Seamus Monahan is here with us now. And I think what we're trying to do as staff is trying to get him long-term and do 100% contract with the Attorney General's office. But so this is one of the things that they want, the Auditor General's pointing out, is that there's not any consistency. And so what should happen, in my opinion, and I don't know, I don't have any guidelines as to LOC, non-discipline, discipline, but if you find a violation, not you, but if the board finds violation prior to issuing a response or disposition of the case, they should request prior history. Board staff looks it up every single month, and we probably haven't done a good job of explaining it to you, and we had an attorney that would, I remember screaming at you guys, you were asking certain questions. That was a challenge for sure. And so I think the board got scared, like, when do we ask? How do we ask? When's the appropriate time? So it's as you find a violation, you can ask for priors. And if there is something similar in line with the current one, then the board can take kind of a graduated disciplinary measure. Because if you did an LOC for record keeping, now you could do, well, we did record keeping before for LOC. Now I think we should ratchet this up to non-discipline and do CE in record keeping or discipline or whatever. But and so that's what this whole purpose, and that's why this committee now exists, is to try to develop some sort of guidelines to guide the board in its understanding, and not as a substantive policy statement, but more guidelines of how to run the meeting. And Dr. Hero, I think you're doing a great job at running the meeting. I'm just simply saying at the conclusion of your cases.
Right.
Yeah, and the priors thing should be after the all of the violations have been identified. Because that's gonna give you a picture of how serious it is. Because you could have multiple violations. And the board should know how to frame a motion that says this constitutes a violation of this part of the statute. And I have to say that I have rarely seen that. And that it isn't really appropriate to decide how you're going to punish the person until you identify how many of these things are considered violations.
Dr. Caputo.
So a few things. First, I think the best reason to disregard substantive policy is just too hard to say the word. So that's one observation. Second, one of the things I'm hearing pretty clearly from what a lot of people are saying, and I think this should come in some form of recommendation to the board, and it's certainly something that the investigative committee is considerate about, and that is having content, essentially content experts, that can address issues more thoroughly and probably to a more detailed level than someone who doesn't have that level of experience or knowledge. And so I think that that's important, and I also think it's important from the perspective of consistency as well, because as we've all recognized, we may not be here for a while or who knows how long, and other people will come. That's the normal process of things, and so certainly a commitment to consistency is a theme that's coming up within this group currently. The last thing I'll say, and I'm just only saying this from somewhat of a level of maybe confusion and maybe just a curiosity, but that is this idea of process and the board ultimately making decisions. I certainly get that part, the last part about the board ultimately making decisions, but it's my understanding that the purpose of the current investigative committee is to sort of do the heavy lifting following the investigation completed by the consultant and make recommendations to the board. And we follow the very process that is being discussed. If we determine a violation has been made, that's then when we have the discussion about priors. And we make decisions about what to recommend to the board. And the reason why I'm saying this from a perspective of confusion is, it would seem to me that once the board gets our recommendations, they're going to have to know whether there were priors or not regarding that particular complaint based on the report that's being made and the recommendations being made by the IC. Thank you.
Kevin?
And I'm wondering whether or not it is appropriate for the investigative committee to draw conclusions as to sanctions. They're fact finders, and perhaps a better way to approach the investigative committee is, let's identify what the deviations, let's identify what the violations are, and it's really up to the board to determine what the sanction is. Because maybe you may get caught up in appropriate sanctions at the investigative committee level, and it may tend to make your investigative committee meetings go better because it wouldn't get caught up in terms of how to sanction someone.
Just a Forgive me, but I think it's exactly the opposite. I think that's the whole purpose of the investigative committee is to duke it out there and make recommendations to the board so the board's not duking it out. And I think the whole purpose of the investigative committee was to try to take some of that pressure off of the board and give them more consistent recommendations. So I see it as just the other way around.
Yeah, I mean, the intent when the committee was formed was definitely to come up with a recommendation for action, present it to the board. The board would consider that recommendation and proceed appropriately. Dr. Caputo.
And just to tail on to what Skip was saying, the way we look at it is the consultants are the fact finders. So the consultants are putting the report together and they're presenting to the investigative committee their findings of facts. They're not coming to any decisions. They're just identifying what they see is a deficiency or error within that investigation that they performed. And then we process it from there, as Skip has explained. Now, having said that, and thinking about this process, another recommendation that we want to make, and I certainly see this, and I would be happy for anybody else to jump in and either confirm or otherwise, but I see a lack of consistency amongst the consultants. So I'll see some consultants that give a very detailed, thorough report, and they have their findings of fact. And then I have consultants that maybe don't do the same level of detail, but they'll oftentimes their conclusion is to let the board make the decision. And I don't think that's helpful to us because if we're not getting an indication from that consultant of whether there was a deviation or other type of issue, we really end up having to go and review the whole chart on our own and determine where the deviations occur. So that consultant report ultimately isn't helpful to us if they haven't sort of done their part. And so maybe that's a recommendation to make on a consistency end is putting a process in place for the consultants that's standardized that they all follow. Thank you.
This is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm sorry I got kicked off the call there. But I did hear that there was a question as to who should carry the majority of the weight when it comes to determining these investigations. And I just wanted to make sure we're all on the same page that the consultants bring factual allegations to the investigative committee. The investigative committee reviews those, makes a disciplinary recommendation or a non-disciplinary or a recommendation to dismiss. Then it goes to the board. But really, the board should be doing the heavy lifting. The board should be reviewing everything top to bottom. And I think that's an area where we may have an issue if we start relying on the consultant's report and the investigative committee, then we may not have all our board members reviewing the material as closely as possible. So I just wanted to make that clear. The board needs to do the heavy lifting. They're the decider of everything. Thank you.
Kevin,
I just need some clarification here. Does the investigative committee have access to priors? That's where I think that I think that's problematic.
Yes, they do. They do.
I think it's problematic because it puts bias into the recommendation. I mean, they, you know, based upon what you see here, this would be the level of sanction, but I think. In my humble opinion, I think only the board should have access to what the priors are.
So I don't want to see us go too off on a tangent with this. I think, you know, we should bring it back around to what's our first step forward.
Before you do that, though, Kevin has a really good point there is if, as a board member, we can't look at the priors, but then the investigative committee can, because we can only look at the priors if it elevates to a certain level, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
We can only allow those to factor into the type of action we would make if it's first determined that it's unprofessional. So, yeah.
But
the investigative committee reviews it the same way you do.
Okay.
They don't have access to that information ahead of time.
Got it. All right. As long as they're not given like a list of all the priors along with all the information, and then we don't get that, or, you know, and I'm with Kevin on that. I don't know if we need to have access to the priors until they escalate a certain amount, but I guess priors are also public record. So.
Jeff.
Yeah. What do you do in the case if the committee believes that it's unprofessional conduct and they list the guy's got priors and therefore we're recommending a higher thing, and then it goes to the board and the board says we don't think it rises to the level of unprofessional conduct. Now the genie's out of the bottle and you've already seen it. So I see that as a potential problem if the committee puts any of their
I apologize. We're not talking about the investigative committee here. This is an ad hoc committee to make recommendations to the board as the guideline process. I don't want to get too down into the nuts and bolts of the investigative committee because that's not the purview here.
Thank you, Seamus. So go ahead, Ryan.
So the board they do exactly the same thing. And when the board sees a recommendation from either the old IRC committee or now the new committee, they're reviewing just the recommendation, but they're not reviewing a comment about, so I get the genie out of the bottle comment, but they're not looking at, they're just looking at the recommendation as a whole, not that the recommendation is X because they based it on a prior. The board still has to request priors if they also find this a violation of the statute.
Okay. So next step, do we like this idea of a flow chart and trying to have that be a launching off point for how we want to establish these guidelines?
Can you give us an example of flow chart, like just take maybe Endo or something and just kind of, I guess the one of the things I look at it is it's really, I mean, all right, so you don't have rubber dam. That's one thing. You're less than 2 millimeters from the radiographic apex. That's another. I mean, are you going to say when you climb to this level, it's no longer, a non-disciplinary CE. Now it gets to, I mean, I just see this as a really hard nut to try to put on paper.
Nor should you try. No, I'm not. I don't think we should even remotely try to get into the standard of care. Nor do I think the flow chart should have anything regarding standard of care on there. I think it should be much larger branches. So, and I'm just going to throw this out of the concept. So, I think the flow chart should start with the licensee, and the first question will be, did the licensee have a license for the procedure that the complainant's complaining about? And if it's yes, then you move to the next box. If it's no, then it should be referred for unprofessional conduct or maybe even referred to the police for practicing without a license. I'm thinking of anesthesia license in that particular case. Then the next thing should be, was there a failure of the standard of care? And then the next, and if it's no, then the flow chart should go recommend to the board for dismissal. And if the flow chart says yes, it should say, okay, was the deviation from the standard of care minor or moderate or egregious? And then each one of those will differentiate. And maybe we should have if it was minor, was the patient made whole? If yes, then recommend letter of concern or dismissal or non-disciplinary conduct. If it's a severe egregious of the standard of care, then and the patient was not made whole, then it's definitely disciplinary, you know, see, like, I think we ought to start at least with the big branches of a Christmas tree. We can fill out the little tiny branches later maybe, but I don't think there's consistency on the big branches, let alone getting into the weeds. That makes sense?
So thoughts on that, Kevin?
Well, I think you may start at the big branches, but then when you're looking at a case, you're going to find certain elements that that may be problematic. That would, for example, let's say we're doing an anesthesia case, and there's a, you know, let's not say necessarily a patient death, but let's say some incident happened in the context of administering sedation, for example. In the investigation, they find that the support staff didn't have adequate training on emergency procedures, that they are the necessary antagonist drugs were not available. Or I had a case back in New Jersey where it was a developmentally disabled child, and there was no pediatric airways in the facility, so they couldn't administer positive pressure oxygen. So all those are all sort of different aggravating circumstances that give you a better idea of, okay, how serious is this? You know,
all of those are failures of the standard of care.
Well, yeah, but you know, there's got to be things that sort of. There's usually like a whole series of errors, or if there's like one error that happened in the midst of this thing, then the one error would deviate around to perhaps non-disciplinary or a letter of concern. So, you know, it depends on how serious it is. And your report from your consultant should be able to identify exactly, you know, what were the errors? What was the problem with this endodontic procedure? What was the problem with the way this crown was seated? If the, you know, the post-operative x-ray showed that there was an open margin on it and they didn't take steps to correct it. And you have a relatively low bar to institute discipline because even a bad margin on a crown in years past, people would get sanctioned for it. I mean, Arizona had this reputation of being the most punitive dental board in the country at one point.
If we try to make a flow chart or any rules or any substantive policy statements that talks about open margins, we're screwed.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that. I think we've just got to sort of try to figure out a format that would work. You know, it's going to take some time. And it also might be helpful if Ryan polls his colleagues from around the country. Does anybody else have any disciplinary guidelines that might be helpful? We're going through this process. If you have, don't reinvent the wheel, you know, work with your colleagues.
Mr. Diner.
Thank you. I was listening with much interest with the discussion that was happening, and I was agreeing with a few things and I was disagreeing with a few things, as I usually tend to do, as Dr. Morrow pointed out. So here's my thinking to Dr. Hero's question as to what are the next steps. I think we should stick to the four corners of the auditor's report. I mean, much of this is sort of, oh, what happens in this kind of a scenario? It's all speculative and conjectural to me. I mean, my thinking is look at recommendation 1 and 1A. 1A says establishing when to use non-disciplinary versus disciplinary actions. That's a very specific and narrow recommendation that we received from the auditor's report. Recommendation 1B, implementing a graduated and equitable system of sanctions. Again, very specific and narrow. Recommendation 1C, documenting its consideration of mitigating and or aggravating factors. So I think as a rule of thumb or as a starting point, as Dr. Harrell calls it, let's take those recommendations and see what we can build on top of it. Because I mean, I'm not opposed to or I'm not in favor of a flowchart or you know, any of sort of like a rubric or some kind of guiding principles, like the substantive policy statement. I mean, I just want to keep an open mind and I just want to state that on the record because let's all keep an open mind and see what recommendations we can come up with for the full board to implement the auditor's recommendations to us, right? And because they are specific and narrow, I think that's the starting point, and that's the limited scope of this ad hoc committee. And I think, I mean, going back to Dr. Harris' initial question, that's, I think, in my mind, the starting point.
Appreciate it, Mr. Dinar. Thoughts on that?
I think we have trouble with consultants and committee members understanding the difference between mitigating and aggravating factors. I think it's that basic.
I agree with Mr. Dinar that sticking with starting maybe with the auditor's report is probably makes the most sense. I'm trying to find a way to kind of keep us focused and forge ahead. And one, we should be responding to the auditor's report. And two, it does give us a launching off point. I mean, we can go through one by one and start initiating our responses. And then out of that, it may mushroom into something else we haven't thought of yet, to your point of an open mind. Mr. Dinar. So I do like that suggestion.
So then can I just add, thank you, Dr. Hero.
Sure.
On recommendation 1A, I think the answer is easy, at least to me. I mean, I understand why it can be difficult, but maybe I'm jaded or maybe I'm too sort of, in the weeds, so let me know. But the way to distinguish disciplinary versus non-disciplinary is just, sort of the severity of the violation in my mind. And some of this is actually spelled out in the substantive policy statement number 24 that Mr. Tana pointed out. Dr. Morrow mentioned, he was sort of stumped as to how I approach cases, but I mean, there isn't sort of a matrix or there isn't a flowchart because the act of sort of judging these things is a very nuanced process. It doesn't lend itself to a sort of, just an if-then sort of a electronics engineering sort of a chart. I think the factors there are something to think about. I mean, there's the severity of the offense is definitely something that should be in a decision maker's mind. The kind of harm and the continuing harm to the patient is, another factor that should be considered. And I mean, eventually there could be, 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 multiple factors in people's minds and the decision maker's minds. And the thing that the decision maker has to realize is it's not a checklist. It's sort of a totality of the circumstances, sort of a test. So any sort of guidelines or any kind of factors we come up with, we do not, at least in my mind, want to create an impression that, these are the only exclusive ways of deciding something, because decision making is a very nuanced process. I'm in front of judges, Mr. Tana can tell you, on more than one occasion, let's just say, and it's a very different process than just looking at flowcharts, just looking at prior, just looking at some kind of administrative stare decisis, which doesn't exist. So those are sort of my initial thoughts.
Thank you. Mr. Tana.
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Dinar. How about if we want a starting point, what about a list of factors? Because it really is a graduation. Is it a little harm, more harm? But I'm thinking of factors like, was the patient repaid? What was the injury to the patient? Did it involve, did the unprofessional conduct involve more than one discipline? What if we all thought of a list of factors to consider when deciding between discipline and non-discipline? Would that help?
Yeah, I think so. Dr. Morrow, what do you think?
Yeah, it's sometimes so hard to do that though, because some of it's just a picture. I get an x-ray and I can see the difference between disciplinary and non-disciplinary by looking at a photo of an x-ray. Instead of saying this does this and all the intricacies. But if you've got a case came before us a while ago that they did root canals on all the teeth without rubber dams in order to save the roots. And I look at it and without even reading anything, I look at it and go, this is egregious. There's a lot going on here. And so sometimes it's just how you look at the case, but it's hard. It's going to be hard to pinpoint what's that factor. That's hard. I think there's certain things we can do, but there's a lot of gray.
The another source of difficulty, but I think this is on point with what you said, Jeff and Mr. Diner. For example, we had a case, I think it was at the last meeting, where it was a malpractice case with a pretty decent sized settlement. The dentist was doing an anterior root canal without a rubber dam. The licensee states he always uses rubber dams. He had it on. He took it off because the angulation of the burr wasn't allowing him to clean out the root. So he took it off. File slipped out of his hands. Patient swallowed it. He finished the root canal. The patient went to the hospital. It took, I think, 2 surgeries to retrieve the file. I mean, the harm done to the patient was significant. But the real violation, oftentimes we would find a letter of concern. So it was a difficult, I mean, the board was really divided, and not that you had certain board members on one side and certain on the other. Everybody was a little hesitant to escalate it to disciplinary action because it was an offense that would typically warrant a letter of concern. However, it was a violation of the standard of care. There was significant harm done to the patient. So if I remember correctly, we ended up ordering disciplinary action. I think it was the context of a formal interview, so we were able to do that. But there's a lot of nuance there. I understand that we're not going to have a checklist to it, but there should be some language adopted here that addresses that, because it's, as a board member, that's a difficult scenario to find yourself in. Skip?
I mean, isn't the point that we're trying to figure out a way to at least remove some of the nuance? I mean, the reality is we exist because there's too much variety in the opinions that we're creating, and that's because all of these circumstances are incredibly nuanced. But isn't the goal of this committee, when addressing this one particular finding, to try to figure out a way to remove some of the nuance, to try to create a broad stroke approach to at least some of the decision-making process?
Definitely, because without that, we're right back to the lack of consistency that we have. What
exactly.
I'm wondering, as we're approaching 5 o'clock, where I think we should probably call this, what we've done in the anesthesia and sedation committee meetings that have helped with the progression is, outside of the committee, some of the members would put something together, hand it over to Ryan, or even work with Ryan or some board staff on it, and then it would be available at the next committee meeting. So maybe Skip with your flow chart and Jeff with your suggestions, maybe you guys can work on something kind of outside the meeting, get it to Ryan or work with Ryan on it, and then we can look at it at the next meeting. I'm sure it's going to morph to some extent. You know, it's not going to be, yeah, we're taking this 100% and excluding this. It's probably going to be some kind of combination. That might help with some progress going into the next meeting, if you guys are okay with that. But I'm putting Jeff and Skip on the spot here. So, I mean, what do you two think about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Maybe Skip does the Christmas tree flow chart and I do the factors.
Maybe we all submit a list of factors that we think are important, and maybe a list of aggravating and mitigating circumstances that we think are top 10, and then we can combine them together and give that as a jumping off point.
Sure. But what does the committee think?
The only caveat, and with all due respect to Skip, he sees everything through the eyes of a surgeon. He doesn't deal a lot with endo. He doesn't deal a lot with pedo, you know, and what I think that we got to make sure we have probably a general dentist to look at some of the other stuff on there too.
But I don't think this should be specialty based. I don't think we should get that detailed. I think we should try to focus on really big, broad strokes. Was the patient made whole? Was the intent, like we were talking about severity of the problem, but I think personally when I approach these cases, my first look is intent. Did the guy really try hard to do right by the patient and it just went sideways? Or was the guy actually malevolent? You know, like I've seen patients die where the dentist did everything in their power right. And so the severity was really high, but the intent was really low. I don't think we need to be talking about standard of care minutiae. I think we need to be talking about broad strokes, at least at first.
And I think, sounds good. Dr. Moore, I think with you and I on here, we're going to hone that as it comes up. What I think we should avoid to an extent is everybody submitting something. I mean, certainly if you've got thoughts that are going through your head and you want to submit it, please do so. I don't want to discourage anybody from doing that. But I know with other committees, if all of a sudden we get, you know, seven people writing something up, it's just hard to focus it and go through it. So right now in my mind, I'm kind of looking at Jeff and Skip as maybe the leads on submittal. And then, you know, it's going to morph. We're going to give input and it's going to change 100 times over before we're done with it. But at least the first step, I think, is the hardest. And that's why I keep going back to this is, what's the next step? The Anesthesia and Sedation Committee, I think it took us about a year before we really started honing things in and making progress. I'm hoping we don't see that here. But I kind of like the approach, but, you know, please jump in if you got a different or better idea. Okay. Then why don't we look at that? And, Ryan, please, you know, if you can work with Jeff and Skip to kind of help hone that. I think your input is always very valuable, as much as I tease you. It really is. So why don't we look at doing that moving forward? If other committee members want to submit something, please do so. And, you know, I think we'll look for that at the next meeting.
Okay.
Any other thoughts before we move to adjournment?
I got a hygienist who's going to kill me if I don't go down and go see her patient.
Okay, go ahead, Dr. Morrow. Then we'll move on to any other discussion or action items for future meetings.
I just wanted to thank everyone for their hard work. I know this is a lot of work, but I really appreciate everyone's hard work.
Yeah, absolutely, and I can't reiterate that enough. But if there's no other, if there aren't items that we want to put on the next meeting, which I don't think we should, frankly. I think let's stick with what we got. I'm going to adjourn this meeting and I'll see some of you next week for sure.
One last question. Are we going to have a date for a second meeting or will that be determined later?
We have them listed on the agenda. The next one listed is November 17th and then December 15th.
Okay.
And do we know the times for those by any chance?
I think we're shooting around this time if it works okay for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of like time works for me, but good. Again, depends on everyone else's availability as well.
Okay. Thank you guys. Really appreciate it. I think there's a lot of important work we're doing and I look forward to meeting next time.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
All right.